Now on News Talk, as part of our summer season of documentary on News Talk, PPI-nominated producer Brian Gallagher explores the diverse and colourful stories of people living along the shores of Dublin Bay in the second of a two-part series, Bay Stories.
In part one of this series, we heard how Bono and Captain Bligh, Maeve Binchy and Molly Bloom, Brian O'Driscoll and Count John McCormack, strange bedfellows at first glance, all had one thing in common. They lived, worked, or were educated along the shores of Dublin Bay. The ever-changing bay has shaped Dublin City over the years. So let's hear from some more of those who've made their lives along its shores.
We'd go swimming down in the docks and we'd go swimming in the Liffey.
I've had enough of the hot continental climate. I absolutely love the Irish climate.
It's not that clean, but like it doesn't matter. Like, just get home, get a shower, don't try your best not to drink the water, and then like it'd be grand.
You pretty much never have to leave the peninsula because it has everything.
We go out a bit far in the Talca and we hop into the water and we just swim around, we float around.
What a ridiculous thing, bring a gas stove all the way to the beach to boil a kettle of water and make your tea there, and the obligatory tomato sandwiches with sand in them.
Well, I'm glad we don't have sharks because you can't go out for a proper swim.
And to see the tram and to hear the sounds at treetop level was like a magic wooden carpet floating along, looking over the sea.
So they were up to their waist in sewage. They had to get the number two bus back to Dublin at the end of the day. So they were all issued with Lifebuoy red carbolic soap to put a different smell on them.
You sort of felt you could cycle forever along there just watching that sea as you went by it.
The views are amazing. We look up when we're playing down along the first fairway and you're looking out, and it's a little piece of heaven.
I'm standing on the deck of the pleasure craft, the St. Bridget, and Howth looks spectacular today as the sunlight glints on the waters of the bay, while Howth Head looms dramatically above the sea. The whole sweep of Dublin Bay can be viewed from here, and in the distance can be seen the structures erected to defend this stretch of coastline. Historian Arthur Flynn explains.
One of the most distinguished buildings along the east coast from Balbriggan down to Bray were the Martello Towers. The British government really built the towers, and they were called after a tower, Martello, in France. That's where the name originated from. In fact, there were 30 of them built altogether. And the reason they were built is that the government felt that there was going to be a French invasion. So they were built as watchtowers to spy out, and they were all well armed. There was a lot of artillery and a small force of men on each of them. But the invasion never happened. And three Martello Towers were actually constructed around the Howth area, and they became places of interest and very attractive, and people live in some of them as well.
Nearby, people have lived in Howth Castle for hundreds of years. And way back in 1575, Grace O'Malley taught the residents there a lesson in hospitality.
One of the most important female figures was the pirate queen, Grace O'Malley, better known as Grainne Whale. On her return from London, she sought refuge in Howth from a storm. She was not admitted to Howth Castle, but she took this as a personal offence. So as a reprisal for the action, she kidnapped the heir of the family. When the storm abated, Grainne Whale moved with him back to Mayo, her castle there. The boy was not released until she got a written pledge from the Lord that the gate would never be closed on her again. So anytime she was up there, she was able to go into the Howth Castle, and meals were laid on for her as well. There was a story that it still actually is there, that a place is set at the table in case Grainne Whale or any of her ancestors appear in Howth.
Thank you. Of course, some people don't have to visit Howth. They already live there.
If you're lucky enough to work close to Howth, you pretty much never have to leave the peninsula because it has everything that you need.
Estate agent Dave Kelly lists the attractions of a house in Howth.
From shopping to schools for the kids, 3 golf courses, tennis clubs, yacht clubs, GAA, rugby, pretty much every sporting base and amenity is covered. You've got nice hill walks, forests, people swim in the sea, you've got the beaches down at Burra Beach. So it's one of those areas that, you know, kind of caters for pretty much everything that you need to do.
So who lives in Howth? And what does a house cost?
Well, the Howth area, I suppose, it's very much a family area, pretty much the upper end of the market in Dublin area. You'd have properties ranging from 3.5 to 4 million all the way down to the first time buyer property. It's one of those destinations people tend to hope that they can achieve at some point in their housing career. You know, we're going to get to Howth a third stop down the line or whatever the case is, but it tends to be quite a lot of competition to get into the area, all right.
And where are the fanciest houses?
That'd be up at the Bailey, up at the Howth Summit, with the aspect looking straight into Dublin Bay. So the more premium properties have the full of the bay view from the Dublin Mountains all the way around to Dunleary and then into Dublin Port, so they can see the boats, the ferries coming in and out. And you've got, of course, an unobstructed view all the way along the coastline. So they will be the premium end of the market there.
There are some drawbacks.
Tricky thing is morning rush hour in the evening, and then the really sunny days in the summer, you just get everybody descends on Howth. So if you go up to Howth Harbour, you'll see just tourists as far as the eye can see, and most of it's great for the trade up on the pier, but mostly they want to go out, see the scenes, get up around the hill walks, walk up to the summit, get the views in, but it does kind of bring in a lot of congestion to the roads, all right, yeah. I suppose that's, you have to take the bad with the good.
But the good is very good, and famous people have chosen to live in Howth.
Conor Cruise O'Brien, he lived up there near the summit. There's a number of actors, Saoirse Ronan, Brendan Gleeson, members of U2. You've got Larry Mullen down there near the beach. Phil Innes, yeah, from Borough Road originally. There's a lot of famous people in business as well. The top end of the legal profession and medicine as well. Lots of consultants and the likes live out here because it's close to the hospitals, but it's also a nice area to live.
The Peninsula of Howth also features in one of literature's most famous novels, James Joyce's Ulysses, in which Molly Bloom recalls her courtship there with her future husband, Leopold. "The sun shines for you," he said, the day we were lying among the rhododendrons on Howth Head, in the grey tweed suit and his straw hat, the day I got him to propose to me. Yes, first I gave him the bit of seed cake out of my mouth, and it was leap year like now, yes, 16 years ago. My God, after that long kiss, I near lost my breath. Yes, he said, I was a flower of the mountain."
Hello, Dublin Bay Cruises, Theron speaking. Yes, that's no problem. What cruise were you thinking of taking?
I'm in the office of Dublin Bay Cruises, who run pleasure craft from Howth, Dunleary and Sir John Rogerson's Quay. Theron Garrahy explains how the company came into being.
My dad and his brothers run the ferries that go out to the Aran Islands and do Cliffs of Moher cruises. And Dad saw an opening, I suppose, in the market for something similar in Dublin. Dublin Bay and Howth and Dunleary are beautiful places that a lot of people haven't seen from the sea. So it started in 2013. He got the St. Bridget, a boat that used to be MV Galway Bay. It was down in Galway. And it's now christened the St. Bridget after his mom, Bridget. So he roped us all in as a family. Myself and my sister Aveen are pretty heavily involved with the marketing. It started from there, and this is its third season.
Out on the pier in Howth, passengers have just disembarked.
You see Dublin in a different way when you come out on a boat. Like, you see all the natural beauty of the, as you're arriving into Howth. And actually, you can appreciate the city more when you're coming in that way. You know, you can see all the docklands and everything. It's really beautiful. It's something that we should have had a long time ago. It's long overdue, should I say.
And the trip is well worth it to pay it.
Yeah, and for what they ask, it's such a nice, relaxing thing to do. So I hope and wish them luck. But it's something that we need as a city. Most cities in the world, they all have river cruises. But Dublin hadn't got that, so it's kind of nice to see it.
Eugene Garrahy, the founder of the company, explains his thinking.
Recently we did a little survey between Tala and Kildare. There are 50,000 students. And we were thinking, like,
there's possibly no more than 100 or 200 of those students have ever been out in Dublin Bay. I think the responsibility of the Bay lies in the education of our youth, and we need to get them out there. We need to let them know that heavy commercial activity and the protection of the nature on the Bay and the river can be achieved.
So how does Eugene see this working?
Dublin City is now hosting a World Biosphere site, namely Dublin Bay. And it's the first biosphere site based on a city, first one in the world. And that's very, very significant because for the first time, Dublin Bay has a status where the city and all of its commercial activities is working in harmony with nature.
Back to Dúran and the hustle and bustle of daily cruises. I asked her what sort of people sail on them.
It varies. It's particularly popular with groups. You know, obviously tourists love it. Hen parties, stag parties, work outings, that kind of thing. And if you're lucky, if our Captain Eddie is in a good mood, if you go up to the wheelhouse, he'll give you a quick tour.
And what marine life can you expect to encounter?
You're pretty much guaranteed 100% to see seals out in Howth. So they prove popular with the children. And then we have seen dolphins around Docky Island on that evening cruise. So just depends on the day, really.
Some days, though, are more colourful than others.
It's amazing what happens on board. For example, we have a full wedding coming up in a week's time. And of course, we remember vividly a couple about a year ago. The boyfriend invited the girlfriend out for a trip on the bay. And when we were approaching Howth, he asked us for the mic. And we gave him the mic and he proposed to his girlfriend on board. And we know for a fact that they're now married. So it has some unique events like that.
Just as well she didn't say no.
Yeah, well, he mightn't have made it to Howth in that case.
Sutton Station, Sutton Cross, Grand Road, Howth the Main, same things. Barden Hill, the Bailey, Stella Maris, the Summit, Griffin Road, Island View, and Howth.
The names we just heard were tram stops on the famous Hill of Howth tram line that ran from 1901 to 1959. 90-year-old Pat Dowd was a conductor on the tram, and although it's fondly remembered by former passengers, working on the tram was a demanding job, as Pat recalls.
I started around 6:30, 7 o'clock. We worked 7 days a week. It was an 8-hour day.
Pat's route was from Sutton Cross, along the side of Howth Head, over the summit and down to Howth Village, affording spectacular views of Dublin Bay. But it wasn't just day trippers who used the tram. Servants of wealthy families living on Howth Head used the tramway to get to work.
The Jemisons lived on the hill and the Guinnesses lived on the hill and Coxes, all the big shots. They had maids and that they used to travel on the tram.
As well as doing his job as a conductor, Pat Dowd provided an extra service to his customers, delivering newspapers along the tram's route.
He had got a bundle of papers and we'd throw them out at the houses. We knew all the houses. Any of them that lived down Central Road, there was a little box and they'd leave them on the top. But they were rolled up and all, like, with their name on them, like, you know.
With service like this, it's easy to see why people mourned the passing of the Hill of Howth tram. One such person was Jim Kilroy, who's made a labour of love out of restoring tram number 9. Jim was first taken on the tram by his parents, and the memories of those childhood journeys have stayed with him ever since.
To see the tram and to hear the sounds was magic, and I always felt on the upper deck, the tram groaning as it struggled to go up the hill, the various sounds. At treetop level, it was like a magic wooden carpet floating along, looking over the sea. It was just an amazing series of memories for a child. And those memories made me a slave, if you like, to do something about it. Later on, when I was old enough, I was about 17 when the tram was taken away, I had fallen in love and I would bring my girlfriends on the tram and we'd get off at perhaps Howth Domain, probably carve her name in a tree or do something romantic and go back home by tram. So it had romantic connotations as well. That's why I'm involved with restoration.
Jim spent years restoring tram number 9, one of the Hill of Howth vehicles that fell into serious disrepair after the line closed in 1959. With a group of like-minded volunteers, Jim helps to run the Transport Museum in the grounds of Howth Castle, where the restoration work has been carried out. So, after countless hours of effort, what's the situation with the tram?
We have enough reserve to complete putting the motors back into number 9, putting the heart and life back into the tram. To run a tram is a completely different thing. Laying the track, the overhead cable, the substation, the power runs into millions. So what I say is that my generation, we will have a powered tram capable of running, but maybe the next generation, a benefactor or a more inspired government, might actually lay track and take it over. We would love a sponsor to do that.
The film Mutiny on the Bounty was a major popular success and featured Irish actors Richard Harris and Noel Purcell. But there was another link between Ireland and the Bounty in the shape of its famous commander, Captain Bligh, as Arthur Flynn recounts.
In 1800, Captain Bligh of the Bounty fame was commissioned by the Inland Navigation Board to carry out a complete survey of Dublin Bay.
But despite his controversial command of the Bounty, Bligh was held in some esteem by the authorities.
Would have had a reputation, and he was the one that was commissioned to actually do the project in the first instance. So there was fairly high regard, not just as a captain of a ship. So from the early 18th century, there were many proposals put forward for the development of Dublin Port. One plan proposed the construction of a canal through the sandbanks at the estate of the harbour, with the opening at Clontarf. This did not materialise, but a recommendation by Captain Bligh was implemented.
Bligh's recommendation was ambitious.
It involved the construction of the north wall at Clontarf. In 1820, work commenced and took 3 years to complete, with hundreds of men employed on the project. Water was diverted into a canal between the north and south walls, making the provisions for the berthing of large ships for the first time.
For a long time, sewage disposal by ship was a feature of life in Dublin Bay. Tony Sheehan, captain of the Sir Joseph Bazalgette, the last vessel used for this purpose, fills in the background.
Dublin Corporation, as it was, around 1906, invested a huge amount of infrastructure in treating the sewage. So they developed a series of sediment settling tanks just near the Pigeon House dock. And they allowed the sediment to go into the pens there, and it settled out, and they put it into a purpose-built ship called the Shamrock, or Shamrogue. And the Shamrock then took the treated sewage, just what was settled, and then shifted down to the ship, took it out to just off Hoth, and it dropped it off to what they call the nose of Hoth.
But as Dublin expanded, a much larger vessel became necessary.
They brought in a ship, the Sir Joseph Bazalgette, as it was, which had served the London Council for the same purpose. But this ship was like 2,000 tonnes. It could handle 2,000 tonnes of sewage. And it had to be moored out on the river, as opposed to being in the Pigeon House Harbour, where the traditional berth was for the smaller sludge boats. So the Sir Joseph Bazalgette was a long-time feature then, from about 1985, out on the river berth. And she initially was dumping in the same position off the nose, a Hoot, and they reassigned a new dumping ground 4 or 5 miles southeast of the Kish. So the Joseph Bazalgette then had to go further out, and had a round trip of about 5 hours out and back.
With changing practice, the dumping of treated sewage came to an end, and it was decided instead it should be disposed of ashore.
So they brought in a drying plant, and instead of sending the sludge to a holding tank to be disposed of, say, they held it on site and they dried it in a kiln, a rotating kiln, and it produced little nodules, little basically like nuggets. Well, that was the end of dumping at sea.
Sewage treatment today is high-tech and mechanised, but Tony recalls a time when work practices were challenging, to say the least.
So the men had to get in the waders and put all this stuff with squeegees and that down into the centre channel and physically move it out of the tanks. So they were up to their waist in sewage, and that was the day's work, shoving this stuff into channels to shift it down into the holding tanks. They had to get the number 2 bus back to Dublin at the end of the day. So they were all issued with Lifebuoy red carbolic soap to put a different smell on them.
Even in Tony's time, as captain under Sir Joseph Bazalgette, this tradition remained.
When I was working, you had your entitlements, and one of the entitlements we had, like up to the year 2000, was a bar of Lifebuoy carbolic soap once a week. And the men said, we didn't get our soap this week, even though they had showers and everything else, and they never went near the stuff. Still claimed it, yeah.
In another part of the bay, people pursue a more pleasurable activity. I'm in St. Anne's Golf Club on Bull Island with Mary McCreevy, the ladies' captain. Bull Island was formed when the Bull Wall was built, and Mary tells of the founding of the club.
The golf club started in 1921. Three friends, Marmaduke Montgomery Devitt, Tussie Murray and Dudley Stewart, were three buddies. They enjoyed sailing and fishing, and they decided that they'd start another hobby. So they began playing golf in St. Anne's, and there was a very small clubhouse, a little wooden shack, and it was a nine-hole golf course. And they took on a formal lease of 20 years, which was granted in November 1926.
Shortly after this, the first lady's captain made an appearance.
Maura Barrett, and she came into office in 1928. So it remained as a nine-hole golf course. And then in 1964, the causeway was built, and that created a problem because the clubhouse was on one side of the causeway and the golf course was on the other. So that led to the golf course becoming an 18-hole golf course, and they started a new clubhouse.
I asked Mary why the causeway to Bull Island needed to be built.
It was to gain access onto Dollymount Beach, basically, and the only other access was on the wooden bridge, and then you'd have to come the whole way down along the beach.
So how did people make this journey?
Shanks Mare on the bicycle, and some who were lucky enough to have a car drove down, but when the tide came in, one or two cars were left stranded on the beach. The causeway opened up a whole new access. It's a wildlife sanctuary, and there's all sorts of birds. You see people with their long lens cameras out bird watching all the time now.
Other animals on Bull Island make their presence felt to the golfers of St. Anne's.
We actually sometimes can have an audience off the tee boxes on, you know, several of the holes. But we often see we have resident foxes on the golf course. We have two swans on the 10th. We have rabbits, hares. It's just wonderful. So it's slightly distracting when you're playing golf.
Then in the autumn, there are other visitors.
We have resident Brent geese every September, and they come in their droves and they stay until almost the end of March every year. And it's a beautiful sight when you're travelling up along the sixth hole and you look out to your right, and it's just a wonderful sight to see the Brent geese. So St. Anne's is their second home.
St. Anne's is blessed with a stunning location right on Dublin Bay.
The views are amazing. We look up when we're playing down along the first fairway and you're looking out, and it's a little piece of heaven. You're looking out at the boats coming in and out, and you can see down as far as Dunleary, the sailing and the windsurfers, kite surfers, you name it, we can see it, and it's wonderful.
You're listening to Bay Stories on News Talk 106 to 108.
Nearest beaches to Dublin, Dollymount is a magnet for city dwellers on sunny days.
Beautiful walks all along. It's magnificent. In the summertime
when the weather is high. You have to have a chat, talk over things, have a yet. It's time to see something else.
That whole sense of heat, that summer sense of my childhood where there's ice cream cones with the flakes stuck in them, the 99s, and dead heat.
One of the nicest days they're down here today, isn't it? If a night is poor, just do what you feel. Speed along the lane,
you go down or return at 25. This is my first swim in the Irish Sea in 10 years. It's really warm. It's really nice. It's a big surprise because, believe it or not, I've been waiting 10 years for this moment. It's really, really nice and pleasant. had enough of this hot continental climate. I absolutely love the Irish climate. It may last for an hour, but when it comes, it's absolutely, absolutely fantastic. You know, you're not too hot, like having a perfect summer that's air-conditioned.
There's a bull wall. There's St. Anne's, which is wonderful. Malahide Castle, walk around there, 4.5 kilometres.
I was about 12 or 13, I think it was, a gang of us cycled from Santry to Donymount, and we brought a picnic and cut all the bikes in the dunes, and freezing cold even though the sun was shining. But in Donymount, it was, you know, my abiding memory of it was there was never any depth in the water there. You'd walk for miles and no depth, and then we had to cycle all the way home again half wet. We used to go on bus trips because we didn't have a car when I was a kid. So we all piled on the bus and headed off to Portmarnock or Dollymount, the obligatory tomato sandwiches with sand in them, and orange, which was a big treat, fizzy orange and biscuits. And, you know, when we did get a car, it was bringing the old gas stove, where you then boil a kettle. What a ridiculous thing, bring a gas stove all the way to the beach to boil a kettle of water and make your tea there and with your sandwiches. You got women, you got women on your mind.
Dorina O'Flanagan sails for pleasure in Dublin Bay. I asked her how she got started.
Well, originally I would have sailed with my husband in Kilbarrick Sailing Club, and that was a dinghy sailing club, which was great fun. But then, unfortunately, Kilbarrick closed, and a lot of people then moved to Howth Yacht Club and joined into slightly bigger boats. And so there were regular racing events, which was great fun. And then more recently, we would have moved on to a slightly bigger boat, which is a small cruiser, and use that for cruising around Dublin Bay and up and down the East Coast and even over to Wales or the Isle of Man.
So what's the attraction for the arena?
It's great fun. I mean, there's nothing nicer than when you see all the boats out in Dublin Bay, all around Ireland's Eye, or there's a longer race out to Lambay Island. And that's fantastic to see all the fleets of boats out and crisscrossing across the bay. It's gorgeous. It's a great sight. It really is.
Buying a boat is expensive. Does that rule out sailing for most people?
No, not at all. Not at all. People are always looking for cruise. For a lot of people, you know, they mightn't realise it, but it's always possible to go out and crew on one of these boats. And you just have to go on the website and you can see the boats that would be seeking crews, so that people could apply to that and go out. And, you know, the different sailing clubs then would have sail training programmes for adults or anybody who's interested. So it's a great way to get involved in, which I think is a great sport, which people can do for a lifetime.
Most of us think of sailing as a sunny summer sport, but that's not always the case.
There are the frostbite series, and I can remember sailing sometimes when there'd be ice totally over the boat, and you know, you have to make up that people wrap up very warm, but that can be good fun too.
Over many years of sailing, Dorina has some special memories.
When we had the tall ships came into Dublin Bay, a lot of the boats would have gone out to join the arrival and the departure of the tall ships. And that was a fantastic sight. It was super.
So what's the principal appeal of sailing?
I think, like a lot of sports, it's camaraderie. Over the years, the boats sail in company, and whether you're doing it for racing and competitively or whether you're just cruising and enjoying a nice relaxing sail in company, you know, there's great sights to be seen around Dublin Bay. The two islands, Ireland's Eye and Lambay on the north, and then Dawkey Island on the south. There's lovely scenery to be seen, and the different type of birds, porpoises, the seals, and then for those who enjoy fishing, you know, there's great fishing. So there's a lot to be said for it. Bicycle, bicycle, bicycle. I want to ride my bicycle, bicycle,
bicycle. I want to ride my bicycle. I want to. You sort of felt you could cycle forever along there just watching that sea as you went by it.
Absolutely beautiful morning. The visibility view was fabulous. The cycle path very safe. Lovely morning.
Well, yeah, I mean, this one is particularly nice coming out there by Dollymount and Howth. So the views, and I mean, it's great to get a good day.
The main thing I noticed was the shimmer on the sea. When you drive along in a car, normally you're going so fast, But just to see the sun glistening on the sea and the waves, were, it was a slightly little bit rough to see. It was beautiful to see the sea like that and the shimmer on it. And again, the road was very safe to go along there.
Well, I love the exercise, the company, the friends, the whole social scene of chatting and just seeing Dublin, because when you're driving, you don't get a chance to observe it. Makes you, as a driver, respect cyclists a lot better as well.
I caught up with that group of cyclists using the cycle path that's planned to link Sutton on the north of the bay to Sandy Cove on the south. So what's the official line on cycling in the environs of Dublin Bay? Liam Coughlin, Senior Engineer with Fingal County Council.
The more people that you attract onto cycling, particularly for leisure purposes and young people, they're the commuters of tomorrow. We'd be very interested, like what they do on the continent in some places. I know on the east coast of Italy, they have long cycle routes there that link all the beaches and all the tourist attractions there.
And what has Fingal County Council got in mind for cyclists?
We have plans to link Howth to Malahide and Malahide to Donabate, and then from Donabate to Skerries and Skerries to Balbriggan. We would be very interested in developing the length from Sutton to Malahide and linking that into the Dublin Bay cycle route.
To complete the Dublin Bay cycle route around the full circuit of the bay requires the cooperation of three councils: Fingal, Dublin City and Dunleary Rathdown. I asked their cyclists if they'd use such a route.
Definitely would love it, yeah, definitely would use it, because it was busy enough and, yeah, you'd love to go the whole way around, definitely.
Yes, I mean, I'd love to go all the way out to Howth and around and back. That'd be just fantastic to go that far on it.
If they link that up, that would be a popular one for us, I think.
The Battle of Clontarf covered a wide spectrum, several miles. It went from Bayside in Sutton, along by Clontarf, right out to the start of Fairview. So it was quite an extensive area, because in those days there weren't the buildings, and the tide came in a lot closer to the land as well. But when the Vikings landed, they were sort of in their thousands. So they needed all the space they could get to try and move inland. Good Friday, the 23rd of April, 1014, Brian Boru and his army went down to defend the coastline along by Clontarf, while the Vikings and the other Irish rebels actually came in. So there was widespread massacre. There was 7,000 of the Vikings and their supporters were killed, and about 4,000 Brian Boru's men. Now, Brian Boru was 84 at the time, so he stayed in his tent. He didn't actually get actively involved, although he was sort of pulling the strings from there about the actual battle itself. And after the battle, Brian Boru was actually in his tent praying, and one of the rebel leaders, the Viking leaders, came in with an axe and killed him stone dead. So that was the end of Brian Boru. Thereafter, in the locality of Clontarf, numerous places like Conquer Hill and Brian Boru as well were named in regard to the battle that happened there.
If Brian Boru is synonymous with Ireland, Count Dracula is similarly associated with Transylvania, despite being the literary invention of a Dubliner. I was not able to light on any map or work giving the exact locality of the Castle Dracula, as there are no maps of this country as yet to compare with our own Ordnance Survey maps. I found that my landlord had got a letter from the Count directing him to secure the best place on the coach for me. When I asked him if he knew Count Dracula and could tell me anything of his castle, both he and his wife crossed themselves and, saying that they knew nothing at all, simply refused to speak further. It was so near the time of starting that I had no time to ask anyone else, for it was all very mysterious and not by any means comforting. Spooky Stuff, and written by Dublin author Bram Stoker, who was born on the shoreline of Dublin Bay in 1847 at 15 Merino Crescent. As a child, Stoker suffered ill health and was bedridden. Although he made a full recovery, he later credited this period as a time of fruitful reflection. He studied at Trinity College, became theatre critic for the Dublin Evening Mail, and met one of the leading actors of the day, Henry Irving, whose manager he would become. In 1878, he married Florence Balcombe, and they moved to London. Stoker had already begun writing fiction, and he studied European folklore and mythology regarding vampires before writing Dracula, the novel that would make his name. Dracula was published in 1897, and although Stoker wrote lots of other fiction, it's for the gothic horror of Dracula that he's remembered today. After his death in 1912, his widow published a short story collection, Dracula's Guest and Other Weird Stories, and in 1922, an unauthorised film adaptation was released. But it was the Universal Studios 1931 movie Dracula, starring Bela Lugosi, that helped make the infamous Count Dracula a household name. Today, the image of Dracula is recognised worldwide, quite an achievement for a sickly Dublin boy who once lay in bed in a house in Marino, dreaming the strangest of dreams. Growing up on the shores of Dublin Bay makes for adventurous childhood experiences, as we hear from pupils in St Joseph's schools in East Wall and Fairview.
When it's a warm day out, we go swimming down in the docks and we go swimming in the Liffey, just like for a bit of fun. There's loads of people down there.
A few of my friends go up there and they jump into the dock and have a bit of fun when it's a lovely day. It'll be a few backflips and front flips. A friend next door to me does that as well.
It's not that clean, but like it doesn't matter us. Like, just get home, get a shower, don't try your best not to drink the water, and then like it'd be grand.
We're just off busy East Wall Road, and once upon a time, the bay was almost on the doorstep of these children.
The whole area used to be like just sea. That's why the area is called East Wall, because there's a wall and then the sea pushed back even more. If you looked out the window, you'd see the water just a couple of feet away. But now it's miles away now.
But although the tide may no longer lap against East Wall Road, children in Fairview and East Wall don't have far to go to enjoy water sports.
Going to canoes, we go on our own. We go out a bit far in the Talca. And we hop into the water and we just swim around, we float around.
There's it's like a small building where they keep all the boats and the people bring them down a ramp into the water.
The man sets you up, you have to have all runners and then you get your life jacket and a helmet just in case you fall and bang your head off the rocks. You'll have a helmet on you to save you. And yeah, the weather does be cold. Last year it was alright. You had to get used to the water. If you hopped in the first time it'd be cold, but if you kept popping in and now you get warm.
So what are the advantages of being by the bay?
When it's sunny, you could go for a cycle along Clontarf, or you could go for a swim at the beach.
When you go to the beach, it's real fun. You can do swimming in there. You can get swimming goggles and look under water, fishes, have a little swim, play with the waves, play with the sand.
Going on cycles and walks down Clontarf on the little cycle path, and I also like going for swims on Donnymount.
I went down with my auntie and there's loads of jellyfish and all. It's nice to see like you've got jellyfish and all in our country, and yeah, you don't have sharks, but I'm glad we don't have sharks because you can't go out for a proper swim. And when it's lovely, it's great to go down to Donnymount Bridge, and sometimes we walk and sometimes we don't walk.
Like when it's like, it's not really summertime, but it's sort of like going into like spring and you go for a nice drive down Clontarf.
And then there's the winning combination of scenery and food.
Like going to Hoth, because we get like fish and chips and we walk on the pier and sometimes we feed the ducks and stuff.
When you have an ice cream on the beach, it's just nice and relaxing. Say if you're going for a swim, there's probably an ice cream truck there. Just go in, get your ice cream, go back, sit down and just relax for a little while. Wait about 20 minutes, half an hour, in case you get cramp in the water. Just go back in for a little swim.
I'm standing in the oasis that's Fairview Park, a green lung situated between the busy main road, the Dart Line, and East Wall Road and the River Talca. In the early 20th century, the shoreline of Dublin Bay was different to what we know today, and the site of Fairview Park was a tidal mudflat. Landfill was carried out, the bay became a little smaller, and in the 1920s the park was developed. Today Fairview Park features flowerbeds, open spaces, shady pathways and a children's playground. A far cry from the ugly mudflat that once bordered the coast road, and evidence once more of the ever-changing face of Dublin Bay. When we hear the term shipbuilding, we tend to think of Harland and Wolff in Belfast, or shipyards on the Mersey, or the Tyne, or the Clyde. But Dublin had a shipbuilding industry on the Liffey that lasted for almost 200 years. Mick Curry from the Stella Maris Rowing Club told me the background and took me in his boat to see the site of the dry dock in Alexander Basin.
Well, in the Grand Canal docks, there was 3 dry docks, and it was more for small coasters getting repaired. But they did engineering works there, and then over in the port where the engraving docks were, they built a lot of ships. They built ships for the Navy. I think there was 2 Navy boats, and then there was other coasters built there. They filled it in for the containers, putting containers on it. But now they're talking about opening up one. They filled in the small one, but they're talking about opening up. They hope to get some shipbuilding, because up to a few years ago, there were still boats coming in, getting repaired now. Nothing was being built. But it was casual work, you know, like, yeah, there was work there when a ship came in, and then you were let go. So it was people, there was more and more jobs coming. People want a steady income, and they give it up. And the way it's gone, even in Europe now, shipbuilding's gone more towards the Far East, Korea. You can see it in England now, all up the Tyne, up in Newcastle and Liverpool, all the shipbuilding has gone on right down. So it's all seems to be shifting now.
But as one industry diminishes, another one blossoms. I'm in the convention centre in Dublin's Docklands. It's a hive of activity, and I'm here to meet the executive chairman of the centre, Dermot Dwyer. We've left behind the busy foyer, travelling up to the top of the building.
The views, as you saw yourself from the top, are really quite extraordinary. There's a 180-degree view from the Phoenix Park right out over Dundeary and along the river.
I asked Dermot how the centre's spectacular appearance was conceived.
The overall architect for the design was Ireland's most famous architect, born in Ireland, Kevin Roach, who won the Pritzker Prize for Architecture. The Pritzker Prize is in effect the global Nobel Prize equivalent for architecture. Kevin had done 300 major buildings around the world, but he'd actually never designed one in Dublin.
The centre has been highly successful in bringing major conferences to Dublin.
As we speak, there are 2,500 people in the building who are the people for the ICANN, the World Global ICANN Conference, which is the governing authority, if you like, for the internet. This is where Ireland puts its best foot forward to greet the world. We don't get a second chance at it. This is where it happens.
And Ireland has put its best foot forward.
Since we've opened, we've won 31 global awards, including 3 years in a row being the best international conference centre anywhere in the world.
So who's come to the conference centre?
The Queen had her major event here when she made the historic visit to Ireland. Her major return event, as it's called, was here in the convention centre. We had Angela Merkel here and 17 heads of state last year. This is the building in where President Juncker was nominated for presidency of the European Commission. We see Kofi Annan is in and out of the building on a very regular basis.
Impressive visitors to a site that was once a CIE railway yard. Now, though, the stunning building, overlooking Dublin Bay and the River Liffey, has become a symbol.
The convention centre, with its odd 22-degree angle drum, has become really, with the Calatrava Bridge in front, has become the visual symbol for the new Dublin.
A new Dublin sounds exciting and optimistic, but some people love the bay as it is and are wary of change.
Well, certainly I'd love to see it stay as it is. I mean, if you go to the summit in Howth, don't think you'll see a better view.
Others love the bay, but feel that change could enhance its facilities.
We've beautiful amenities on people's doorstep, and I think there are changes afoot to make it more accessible to people with the cycleway and the pathway along the seafront. And just generally, we're privileged in some ways because we live so close to it, but for people living further afield, it'd be wonderful that they could get more access to such a beautiful amenity.
I see the bay, as the city interjects with it, will be built out as it should be to kind of complete Dublin, which is a fabulous urban capital.
Howth Yacht Club organise an event every 2 years where they take disabled kids out on the boats, and everybody goes out, and there's a great day. They run a pirate theme, and they let the kids pretend that they're attacking a boat with water guns and water balloons. And that's a great event to get as many people out enjoying the bay as possible. And with people coming out to crew and people joining the clubs, I think the more people that we can get out to use facility that we have, the better.
I'd like to see more people using it. I'm delighted to see anybody that uses the bay and to see activity on the river. And I would say that the city authorities and all of us in Docklands are really trying our best to try and get the water it's used and seen to be used, because it's a fabulous resort and amenity.
My hopes for the future of Dublin Bay
are that the water is kept clean, that any pollution that has been there in the past, they ensure that doesn't happen again. The cycle path, it'd be really important to finish that right around the bay as a tourist amenity and promote it. And that Howth and Dunleary, the development there is managed and that it doesn't lose its charm and its rustic look, that aged look, that it's part of our history.
Between Dublin City and Dublin Port and the councils around the bay are starting to work together to achieve what hasn't been achieved before in any other city in the world, where commercial activity and nature can come together and work in harmony.
Bay Stories was produced and edited by Brian Gallagher. Our thanks to all those who took part in the project. This programme was funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with a television licence fee.
To listen back to this or any other News Talk documentary, go to newstalk.com/documentary on News Talk.